From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Neil Jordan made his reputation with his 1986 movie Mona Lisa. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talked to Jordan about writing and directing in England and America. Paul Rudnick's new novel, I'll Take It, is an homage to Shopping with Your Mother. Coming up, Paul and his mother, Selma Rudnick, join us to share their passion for a good bargain. And we have reviews of the new album from soprano Dawn Upshaw and of Marge Piercy's new novel, Summer People. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Neil Jordan is one of the most original filmmakers to emerge from Britain in the 1980s. He's best known as the co-writer and director of the 1986 film noir Mona Lisa. It starred Bob Hoskins as a small-time hood who's the driver for a call girl played by Kathy Tyson. The man they both answer to was played by Michael Caine. Jordan is from Ireland, where he first became known for his novels and short stories. The British television station Channel 4 backed his early films, including Danny Boy and The Company of Wolves, which was a series of supernatural tales based on the Little Red Riding Hood story and werewolf legends. Jordan's first big-budget Hollywood film is a supernatural comedy called High Spirits. It's just come out on home video. I spoke with Jordan when High Spirits opened in theaters last fall. The story is set in an Irish castle owned by a character played by Peter O'Toole. He can't pay the bills, so he tries to make the castle into a haunted house theme park to attract American tourist dollars. Steve Guttenberg and Beverly D'Angelo play a married couple who hope a vacation in the castle will help revive their soured relationship. But at the castle, the character played by Guttenberg falls in love with Mary, one of the castle's real ghosts, played by Daryl Hannah.
Mary?
Who's Mary?
Who's this Mary?
She's a woman. She's a ghost.
Oh, just
no, she's
don't
a woman
start
ghost.
This ghost stuff
She's
again.
Someone I care about, and
what?
It's funny how you can care. I think I'm falling.
Jack, don't stand there and tell me that you're having an affair with a goddamn ghost.
Well, I am.
No,
oh, wait
that's
a minute.
It,
you gotta
that's
give
it,
me a chance.
It.
You can't
Your
just
lawyer,
walk right.
My lawyer, and I hope the ghost has a lawyer because I want to meet him.
You know, the conflict. Here she is. This is Mary.
No, Martin.
This is Mary. Oh.
Neil Jordan, welcome to Fresh Air. Your previous movies have all been pretty dark, either film noir or dark supernatural. And your new movie has the opposite mood. It's a supernatural movie where even death is benign. And even when you die, you're still capable of having a good time.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are incapable of creating both moods, that some people are born to do dark things and other people born to do comedies. You seem to be interested in doing both.
Well, I wanted to make a film that was the most ridiculously happy film that ever happened. You know, it's... people have always said about my films that they need happy endings and, you know, we should change, shouldn't be so dark, and why do they have to die, and, you know, why do the people have to do horrible things to each other? So I thought, well, I thought if I do a comedy, I'll give it the most ludicrously happy ending in the world, where people not only die, but when they die, they're happy. You know, they not only fall in love, but they die for love, but they end up, and then everyone who dies ends up as happy as they possibly can be, you know, as does everybody who's alive. So it's... It was also to make a film about ghosts and the supernatural that was incredibly romantic, you know what I mean? That 'cause most movies about these issues are to do with, you know, death and decay and horror, and I've dealt with that myself, you know, so I wanted to treat ghosts as if they were the most kind of romantic creatures in the world, really.
You must have had to learn how to create a comic feeling, and I say that because there's certain even technical things that you have to do when you're doing a comedy that are different from what you do if you're doing a film noir. Building suspense and building comedy are slightly different, aren't they?
Well, it's terrible to do a comedy, actually. It's awful because if you do a thriller or if you do, you know, a tragic story, or nobody ever says, is it thrilling enough or is it tragic enough? You know, people... But with regard to a comedy, people say, well, is it funny enough? You know, I mean, is it... And so it kind of really has to work at one basic level. It's a terrifying thing to do. I find it quite terrifying.
Oh, and the response is measurable. You could go into a theatre and count laughs.
You kind of... Well, people do. Yeah, it's a terrible thing. You know, people play it in theatres and say, well, they didn't laugh between the fourth and the 56th minute, you know, so what's going on there, you know? And it's... there's a kind of a mechanical aspect to it, which is tough, I think, which is difficult.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Neil Jordan. He's a writer and film director. His new movie, High Spirits, stars Daryl Hannah, Steve Guttenberg, Beverly D'Angelo, and Peter O'Toole. Your previous films were largely funded by Channel 4, the independent television station in England. High Spirits is your first film to have a big budget and to come out of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. What were the basic differences between the options you had on this film and the options you had doing a more modestly funded film in the past?
Well, it's very simple. It comes down to one word. It comes down to freedom, really. If you do a modestly budgeted film, you basically, you know, you're free to shape it as you want. You know, you're free to, you know, die a disaster or, you know, make a masterpiece. When you make a, you know, when you need $12-14 million and you have to get American finance and you make a film that actually needs to play in a Broadway with a public audience, you involve yourself in a whole different kind of conversation, you know, which does mean, you know, a quite severe curtailing of one's, you know, certain kind of freedoms.
So it becomes a little less personal?
It becomes a little less personal. It becomes more an object of discussion between people at board around boardrooms. It becomes less yours, I would say, you know. It becomes more, you know, more a corporate thing and less a personal thing.
Is it worth the sacrifice?
Well, that's the I often think that films were given by, invented by a very, you know, kind of wicked God. You know, he gave us this great medium, you know, that you can achieve more than you can. He said we'll give to people this medium, you know, in which they can achieve more than they could ever possibly dream of, yeah? If they got the resources, yeah? So he said we'll give them this medium in which they can achieve all this stuff, but we'll only allow them to achieve, you know, 1/100 of its potential, really. And it's a battle. If you want to deal with certain subject matters, if you want to deal with special effects, if you want to deal with large events, if you want to deal with a large kind of visual canvas, it costs money, you know. So at a certain stage, one has to enter into that kind of battle, really.
I think the whole sense of casting becomes different when you're making a major motion picture, not only because you have greater access to actors, but you're almost compelled to hire name actors in order to have big names to put on the marquee.
Well, you are and you are not, but there are very good, you know, there are very good actors, you know, that are stars and that names mean something in the marquee. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, I thought we had a very interesting cast in this film, actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was a kind of a wonderful balance in the whole ensemble, which was a delight for me to work with, actually.
Peter O'Toole has such great oratory skills.
Yeah, he's great old theatrical kind of gentleman, isn't he?
Yeah, how did you try to use him in that context, given these great oratory skills that he has? I think you really took good advantage of that.
Yeah, well, we based the part, myself and Peter knew this. Peter is, you know, he's from Ireland and he knows the Irish theatrical lore. There was a wonderful old Irish actor called Anu McMaster, who used to run fit-up companies, in other words, you know, a travelling Shakespeare company in the 50s in Ireland. He was kind of a legend in his day, very theatrical, kind of ridiculous man. And Peter based his performance on that character, you know, basically. This kind of rather grand, passionate, oratorical human being.
You know, it's funny, Peter O'Toole, I think, had a reputation in the past for having an alcohol problem, which I think he overcame. And of course, in your movie, he plays an alcoholic, someone who's always drinking.
Peter is in wonderful shape. He's, you know, very fit. You know, he's had a totally new lease of life. He's delightful to work with, and I'd love to work with him again. He was playing an alcoholic, you know, but of course he was just drinking water.
You're right.
That's the entire film.
Screenwriter and director Neil Jordan is my guest. His new movie is called High Spirits, and it's a supernatural comedy. I think until people see your new movie, you'll be best known for Mona Lisa, which is your film noir of a few years ago.
Yeah.
About a small-time hoodlum working in the sex trades. How much did you know about that world when you co-wrote and directed this movie?
I don't know. Everybody has an image, you know. Every man has a kind of an image of what a prostitute is like, you know. Everybody, you know, they know red light districts. They have there's a kind of series of archetypes that film was dealing with, that people know about, you know, they instinctively know about. But I did a lot of research, you know, when I was writing the script and when I was beginning to shape the movie and to design it. But it's kind of such a drab world, you know, that it's not that revealing at all. You know, I mean, one would go into these peep shows or meet these girls who were prostitutes and, you know, find a combination of broken homes and drug addiction. You know, kind of real kind of suburban sadness, really, which had led to, you know, led to the lives people were leading. And, you know, the reality of that kind of thing is not at all dramatic. And I must say, in the film, I shot it and composed it in a far more lurid way than the real kind of stories would lead one towards.
When you were meeting women who were prostitutes, what grounds did you use to meet them? Did you tell them you were doing research for a movie?
Yeah, they never believed me.
Sure, that must be the oldest line in history.
Yeah, absolutely. No. But I mean, you know, it's very interesting actually because. What I found, well, I wanted to cast quite a few girls who were like that in the movie, you know, and I did end up casting some of them in the smaller parts. Mm-hmm. But what one found was that one had to get through a tissue of lies, really, to begin to speak as a normal human being, you know, because most of the jobs of these girls, their daytime, you know, their kind of waking, working hours were involved with telling men, fat old men, lies, you know, telling fat old men that they like him, that they think they're sexy, they think they're attractive, they want to go to bed with them, do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So when they talked to me as a kind of a filmmaker, a man, they would also tell me lies, you know, so you have to go quite a long way before you actually begin to speak, you know, a kind of down-to-earth truth with people. But I met, it was very tough conditions, you know, very beautiful girls who were covered in track marks and, you know, one would know I was going to die within 4 weeks and stuff like that, you know, it's not a pleasant world.
Well, I want to play a scene from Mona Lisa. You had some really extraordinary actors in there, and two of the actors were Bob Hoskins and Michael Caine. Mm. And I want to just play an excerpt of a scene in which they act opposite each other. And Hoskins plays a small-time hoodlum who's hired to chauffeur a call girl around and keep tabs on her. And Hoskins' crime boss in the sex trade underworld is played by Michael Caine. Hoskins spent time in prison taking the rap for a crime committed by Caine. And here's a scene where they're meeting again.
You know what I think?
What do you think?
I think that you think I left you in the shit.
We did, didn't you? Kind of.
Have a drink anyway, Jill. Life goes on happening. We can't control it. We can only swim in it.
Well, what happens when you can't swim?
You get water on the brain, George.
But that can't be good, Denny.
And you know what happens then, George?
What happens?
You get confused, and always with the little things. You know the little things.
What little things?
Do you or do you not get confused?
Yeah, I'll get confused.
You still get confused?
Yes, I get confused.
Great. Well, at least now you know. You do know it, don't you, George?
All right, now I know.
Well, that's something.
Eh?
Because do you know what I'm good at, George?
What?
I'm good at the little things. The little things that mean everything.
There's so much in the rhythm in which they deliver their lines in that. Mm,
yeah, that's a lovely speech, actually. You know, I enjoyed writing it. It's actually about nothing.
That's the thing. It almost reminded me of this is the wrong example to use, but it almost reminded me of Beckett, because the content, do you know what I mean?
Well, what he's saying, what Michael Caine is saying to poor Bob, is absolutely about nothing at all. You know?
Exactly.
All he wants to do is get him even more confused. You know, but they did it wonderfully. Yeah, I had forgotten that, actually.
Well, in directing that, I mean, you're working with these two great actors who both have fabulous voices and just incredible delivery. What was your role as a director in creating this interaction between them?
Well, that was a complicated scene because there were 200 dancing girls kind of rehearsing this drab sex routine behind them when they were saying it. Don't you remember?
Yeah, we heard a little bit of that stomping around.
Yeah, stomping. That's these kind of Germanic ladies, you know, with the high boots and kind of straps and all that sort of stuff. I don't know, really. It's to get a sense of the character. It's also to get a sense of the broader scene, you know? I mean, to bring out through both of the actors all of the levels of meaning that would be possible within that scene, you know? On the one hand, it's a scene of a hoodlum going back to his boss and asking him for a job and for some money that he owes him. On the other hand, it's a boss kind of trying to say to the hoodlum without... trying to admit it that he doesn't want him anymore. Do you understand? And on the other hand, it's these two old mates, one of whom is saying, "Well, look at me now. I'm far bigger than you ever could be." You know. And on I suppose the last thing is it's the Michael Caine character expressing kind of sense of utter negativity and nonsense about what his life is about and about his vision of the world. You know. It's kind of somewhere in between all of those things. This scene exists. You know, it's a matter of finding that.
No, is it easier to use that kind of language that isn't saying anything in particular to get at that larger meaning in a movie than it is in if that dialogue were in a novel?
Well, the great thing about because there's rhythms in dialogue that kind of only exist when you hear them.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you read Hemingway, he uses short, cryptic lines, but if you actually try and translate those to the stage or to the screen, they actually don't work. I had an interesting experience a few years ago. I was adapting a novel by Dashiell Hammett called Red Harvest into a screenplay, which was never made. And I was trying to use Hammett's dialogue, which on the surface of it seems great, but when I would put it on the page to be read dramatically, you know, it fell to pieces. And the only way I could actually compose the screenplay was to pull from his narrative description and make that dialogue. Do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a different thing, I think, spoken speech. I'm glad you're asking me this, actually. Most people don't even think about these things.
Well, do you find yourself saying your lines out loud when you're writing for the movies to hear how they actually sound when spoken?
Well, you've got two things when you're writing for the movies. First of all, you're inventing the character, and that comes from nowhere. It comes from what the character is. And second of all, you're using kind of modes of speech that are in some way movie language, even if it's a British thriller and a British film noir. Do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You're still using... There's a kind of... a crop of phrases and common phrases that, and modes of speech that one can use as cliches and as remade cliches and as kind of, you know, things that have a rhythm of their own and a life of their own. So there's two elements one can deal with, particularly in a film noir, you know, particularly in a story that is about crime and about hoodlums and about, you know, the underworld and stuff like that.
One other question I wanted to ask you about Mona Lisa. You cast Michael Caine in really a very small role in that movie.
Mm.
And he's a bad guy as well. He's a villainous character. Someone in the underworld who takes advantage of people who are less smart than he is, who are his underlings in the underworld. And it was really one of the best roles I've seen him in years, even in spite of the fact that it was really a small role. Was it hard to convince him to do that? And what made you think of him for that role?
Well,
when usually he's the leading man.
It's very difficult to convince him to do that, you know. I mean, it's he did it because he liked the script, he liked Bob Hoskins, he liked myself, he liked Handmade Films, the company that was making the... that was producing it. And he did it because we could squeeze all of his scenes into 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you have to do with actors of that, you know, that stature. You have to get the time frame as small as possible, you know, and get them in and out as quick as you can. But, he's a great actor, Michael. He was in wonderful in Hannah and Her Sisters, I thought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, he's every now and then he does something magnificent, and then he does a lot of stuff that is not that good, you know. But it's generally the films that aren't good. Well, he remains
exactly
above them, you know.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer and film director Neil Jordan. His new film, High Spirits, stars Daryl Hannah, Steve Guttenberg, and Beverly D'Angelo, as well as Peter O'Toole. It's a supernatural comedy. His other films are Mona Lisa, Company of Wolves, and Danny Boy. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer and film director Neil Jordan is my guest. You started off writing novels before you started making movies.
Yeah.
Why did you want to switch from books to films?
I don't know. I think every writer nowadays is obsessed with filmmaking, you know, with films and with the possibility of film as a expressive medium. I mean, every novelist that I talk to kind of has such a strange dual kind of, you know, attitude towards what I do and towards what filmmakers do. They, on the one hand, they regard it as, you know, a medium that just corrupts their books if they're ever made into movies. But on the other hand, they see the power of the medium and they feel lonely that they're outside of it, you know? I mean, it always affected me. It affected the kind of writing I was doing, the kind of prose I was writing. Films were a very strong influence even on the fiction that I was doing, you know? And it seemed a natural thing to want to write a film script, and having written a film script, it seemed a natural thing to want to make a film. You know, it just seemed a natural progression for me. I had a theatre group at the same time in Dublin, and so had, you know, some acquaintance with stage design and directing of actors and things like that.
Do you have a dual attitude yourself about your love of movies and having left, at least temporarily, writing books? I'm thinking that, you know, hey, if everybody felt that way, who'd be writing books? You know, do you ever feel like, oh, I'm betraying literature by turning my back on it and working for movies?
I felt that very strongly, actually, years ago, because in Ireland, it's a very literary culture, you know, and I was quite well known as a writer, and I was being hailed as the, you know, the new emerging voice, you know, who would do serious things with fiction and would be, you know, was there to be nurtured and all that sort of stuff. When I began to make films, all the older generation of writers felt quite betrayed, you know, quite angry. They felt it was not something that a serious writer should indulge in.
Well, there really hasn't been much of a film industry in Ireland.
No.
Where did you turn when you decided you wanted to make movies?
There's a filmmaker called John Borman who lived next door to me. He lives up in the Wicklow Hills, you know, and he read some of the scripts. He read my books. He read some of the scripts I've been doing and asked me to work with him on several things. So that was really... he did a film called Excalibur, for which I wrote part of the script, and I did a documentary about him making it, and that was the only school I had, really, you know.
Well, you took your... You took one of your screenplays for what in this country is called Danny Boy, what in England and Ireland, I think, was called Angel.
Yeah.
You took that to Channel 4, which is the independent, reasonably new independent television station in England that's been funding a lot of movies. And they funded your first screenplay. And they let you direct it as well, which I think is a pretty...
Extraordinary.
Thing for them to have done. You had absolutely no experience directing.
Absolutely. None, I had none whatsoever. But sometimes that's... that can be a fresh thing, you know, because, I mean, I did not know anything about, you know, the normal ways in which motion pictures are shot. I didn't know about complementary close-ups, the idea of coverage. I didn't even know what it was, you know. All I knew was the script that I had and what I wanted to see on the screen. You know, so I would shoot... I just shot the film exactly as I wanted to see it on the screen. And sometimes actors would get quite annoyed, you know, if I would play a scene off them, you know, and I wouldn't even cover their aspect of it, you know, and they said, well, why aren't you doing a shot of me? And I said, well, I don't think we need it, really. I just wanted to do this bit, you know. So the editor had very little to work with, and there was only one way to put the film together, which led to certain kind of jaggedness in the cutting of it. But, you know, it leads to, I think, quite a bit of freshness and...
You've shot at least two of your movies that I know of in Ireland, the new movie High Spirits and your first movie, Danny Boy. There aren't many movies that are shot in Ireland. Were the neighborhoods in which you were doing location shooting prepared for what it was going to mean to shoot there?
Well, there's quite a lot of television work goes on there. There's quite a lot of small films goes on there. There's quite a lot of international productions that come in to do, you know, location work there and things like that. So there's a kind of an industry there, you know, but there's almost like a service industry. So, you know, for one who wants to make a film there, there's a lot of backup and there's good crews and all that sort of stuff. I didn't have any problems like that.
Why is there so small a film industry in Ireland now?
Because it's a very poor country, basically. That's the beginning and the end of it, you know. There's, you know, in some areas of Dublin, there's 40-50% unemployment, and you know, if there's a, you know, a continuing kind of conflict up the north of Ireland, and I suppose the government have other things to think about than putting money into film, which is a pity.
Is that part of the reason why you're trying to shoot films there?
Well, I live there, you see, and I want to continue to live there.
You still do live there?
Oh yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, you know, you can't leave your language and your culture, and you can't leave the things that. You know, that inform your heart, that inform your instincts, you know. You can't abandon them. So I'd say the most interesting films I would make would be about Ireland and set there, you know. As well as that, at the moment I'm, you know, I'm making larger, more expensive films that with, you know, that are with American finance and for studios and things like that. And I think I want to make it always possible for myself to make smaller and cheaper films, you know, with the kind of freedom that you have doing those.
Mm-hmm. In your film Danny Boy, it's about a saxophonist who witnesses two murders outside of a club where he's playing, and there it's an underworld murder, and that sets the film in action. You were a musician yourself, right? You played
saxophone? Yeah, that film was based on an incident that happened in the north of Ireland. I used to play saxophone with a what would be called a show band, a kind of a dance band. And we used to travel in the conflict in the north of Ireland, musicians were traditionally immune. You know, they would be able to travel all around the north of Ireland and the south, and there was a kind of an interplay between the music community that wasn't, you know, that wasn't allowed in other communities. You know, and at one stage, a bunch of, I think it was 12 musicians were taken out of a van and machine gunned and killed. That was what sparked the incident in my mind. You know,
and that really shook you up and ended up.
Yeah, well, it's a horrific thing when you see. I mean, one thing that music is to do with pleasure and light, and you know, bringing pleasure to people's lives, and as being a basically harmless kind of activity, you know. And when you think of a guitar player and a bass player and a drummer, you know, just being taken out and shot because of what they, you know, where they were born, it's you know, it's a very shocking image, and it also put into my mind a film about death, about, you know, political death. That was, you know, that allowed you the contrast of everything that music means, you know. So I kind of tried to shoot it almost like a musical, you know, and in terms of the color and the, mm-hmm. You know, the design and the lights and things of that. It was a very dark story, but shot with this odd sense of fantasy to it.
I ask you this because most of your films have been dark, but your new film is a comedy. Do you see your own life as being mostly a drama, a tragedy, or comedy?
comedy.
You do?
But a very bad one, you know, very, very, you know, kind of a farce, I would say, really. It's a bedroom farce, I would say.
would you explain?
No, I can't. It's too personal.
Okay. Your next film is going to be a remake?
Yeah, my next film is a film called We're No Angels, which is a script written by David Mamet.
Oh, great.
And it's for Robert De Niro and Sean Penn. It's a period film set in 1935.
I find it really interesting that you'll be working with De Niro and Penn. I think they're both extraordinary actors, but also Penn seems to, in some ways, have modeled himself on De Niro.
There's a mutual fascination there, I think, you know. It is mutual, actually.
It's between those two actors?
Between both, yeah, it is. Yeah.
What's the basis of that fascination?
I think it's the tradition of acting they both come out of, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a thing you don't find anywhere else in the world. This that particular style of film acting, I find it fascinating, you know.
Which style?
I don't know what you'd call it. I mean, I don't want to call it the method because that seems to denigrate it, really. It's the it's a thing that I suppose comes from Lee Strasberg to Marlon Brando to Robert De Niro, you know, to quite a few younger actors now. It's quite unique. I think it's a unique contribution to the state of acting that American cinema has given. It's you don't find the kind of intensity you got from Robert De Niro and figures like that anywhere in, you know, in any other film culture, I think.
This will be the first movie that you direct that you haven't written, or at
yes.
least co-written.
Absolutely, yeah.
Are you? I mean, how do you feel about that? I'm sure you like to direct.
Well, it's a relief. It's a relief not to be criticizing your own work. You know what I mean? Not to have to be saying who wrote this stuff anyway. You know what I mean?
Got to take responsibility for it.
I can't blame myself anymore. You know, it's an odd position, actually, for me to be in, because every film I've done before, I've really done it because I've written it, you know what I mean? I've said,
right,
this is the story I want to tell, you know,
right,
this is the way I want to tell it, and I've spoken to the actors on that basis. This is quite unusual, you know, it's fascinating for me, really.
Well, I wish you good luck with it. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Neil Jordan's latest film, High Spirits, has just come out on home video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll have a live concert with blues singer, songwriter, and pianist Charles Brown. He topped the R&B charts in the 40s and 50s with songs such as Driftin' Blues and Hard Times. I hope you can join us.
If you ever plan to motor west, take the highway going my way, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Compulsive shopping is some people's dirty secret, but Paul Rudnick says with some pride that for him, shopping is on a par with career advancement and spiritual pursuits. Coming up, we meet Paul and the woman he says initiated him into the pleasures of a good bargain, his mother Selma Rudnick. A family shopping spree is the subject of his comic novel, I'll Take It. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new album by soprano Dawn Upshaw. Lloyd says Upshaw's unpretentious Americanness makes this album a delight. And critic Maureen Corrigan has a summer reading suggestion. It's Summer People, Marge Piercy's novel about a threesome on Cape Cod. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A bitterly divided Supreme Court ruled today that states cannot impose criminal punishment on peaceful protesters who burn the American flag. By a 5-4 vote, the justices said Texas authorities violated a protester's rights when they prosecuted him under a state law barring desecration or destruction of the flag. 47 other states and the federal government have similar laws. In another case, the Supreme Court ruled that a newspaper in Jacksonville, Florida, did not violate a rape victim's privacy when it published her name in a story about the crime. Details from Roger Adams of member station WUSF.
In October of 1983, the small black community newspaper, The Florida Star, published the name of a rape victim because of a mix-up in its police blotter section. The woman sued, citing a Florida law prohibiting newspapers and broadcasters from making public the names of victims in sexual offense cases. A lower court awarded the woman $97,500 in damages. Today, the Supreme Court overturned that ruling and stated that the Florida law violated the newspaper's constitutional right to freedom of the press. St. Petersburg attorney George Roddert represented the Florida Star.
In simplest terms, the broad implication is that this limits the ability of government to engage in censorship. This is a law that says, thou shalt not print truthful information.
The ruling was especially important for the Florida Star because the damage award would have put the newspaper out of business. For National Public Radio in Tampa, Florida, this is Roger Adams.
The United States expressed its regret today at the execution of three men who participated in China's pro-democracy demonstrations. But Secretary of State James Baker said that Washington is not planning any further sanctions against Beijing. Baker said President Bush is satisfied that sanctions announced previously are adequate for now. The Chinese carried out the first death sentence today, executing three Shanghai men convicted of setting fire to a train that had killed six demonstrators. Beijing Radio says a Shandong court has handed out an unspecified number of additional death sentences. Transportation was severely disrupted throughout Great Britain today by a 24-hour train strike, coupled with a subway and bus strike in London. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has the story.
Today's strike produced a total rail shutdown in Britain, as well as a halt to all public transportation in London, the first time that's happened since the 1920s. But the traffic chaos that had been feared today failed to materialize, mainly because warnings about severe congestion prompted many people to stay out of central London, or if they had to, avoid commuting altogether by staying in local hotels. Some of those who had to drive found traffic was actually slightly less gridlocked than usual. But today's strike won't be the end of it. Union leaders said today they're planning more transportation strikes, perhaps one day each week, until their demands for higher pay and better working conditions have been met. The British government today condemned the strikes, but officials have been unable to halt them in the courts. British Rail officials say they want to negotiate, and a new round of talks is expected. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
South Africa's governing party leader, F.W. de Klerk, today began a European visit in London. 40 members of Britain's House of Commons signed a motion urging Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher not to see de Klerk. They described his visit as unwelcome and damaging to prospects of dismantling apartheid in South Africa. A U.S. soldier stationed in West Germany has pleaded guilty to espionage charges. 21-year-old Michael Perry admitted he gave defense secrets to East Germany just as his court-martial began today. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 7 points to close at 2466.05. Declines led advances 3-2 on volume of 170 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Dawn Upshaw is a young soprano who not only sings opera at the Met, but contemporary music with the Kronos Quartet. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of her new recital album on the Nonesuch label, which includes opera arias and concert music all sung in their original language, English.
It has become the time of evening when people sit on their porches, rocking gently and talking gently.
One of Dawn Upshaw's most attractive qualities is her open-hearted, unpretentious Americanness. Her new album has a photo of her in shirt, jeans, and socks, but with no shoes. And it's delightful to think that the four works she sings on it are by four American composers with astonishingly diversified cultural backgrounds. Samuel Barber was born in Westchester, Pennsylvania in 1910. John Harbison in Orange, New Jersey in 1938. Giancarlo Menotti came to America from Italy when he was 17. Yet he's the composer of what is probably the most popular American opera ever written, Amahl and the Night Visitors, which he wrote for NBC Television in 1951. The fourth composer is Igor Stravinsky, who was an American citizen for just over 2 years when he started work on his only full-length opera, The Rake's Progress. The libretto is by the American poet Chester Kallman and another naturalized American, W.H. Auden. The starting point of the album is the most American piece of all, Samuel Barber's nostalgic Knoxville, Summer of 1915, written in 1947. It's a setting of the autobiographical fragment by James Agee that became the opening of his prize-winning posthumous novel, A Death in the Family. Here's the Agee family, lying on quilts on their backyard lawn, talking quietly of nothing at all under the starry sky.
All my people are larger bodies than mine. With voices gentle and meaningless, like the voices of sleeping birds. One is an artist, he is living at home. One is a musician, she is living at home.
Upshaw's version of Knoxville can't replace the more eloquent, intensely felt recording by the great American soprano Eleanor Stieber, who commissioned it. But Upshaw is completely lovely and convincing on her own terms. Her new version of John Harbison's Mirabai songs, however, is miles better than its previous recording, also on Nonesuch. This is a dazzling cycle of six poems by the 16th century Indian poet Mirabai, translated into English by poet Robert Bly. When Mirabai's husband was killed in battle, she refused to die on the pyre with him. Instead, she dedicated her life to Krishna. Her poems are devotional and erotic, and she sang and danced them in the streets. Harbison's music captures what Mirabai calls her dancing energy. I prefer the vibrant rhythms of the original piano accompaniment, but conductor David Zinman and the Orchestra of St. Luke's make the best case yet for Harbison's colorful orchestrations. Here's Mirabai mocking critics of her unorthodox behavior.
Approve me or disapprove me, I praise the mountain energy, night and day. I take the old ecstatic path. I don't steal money, I don't hit anyone. What will you charge me with? I have felt the swing of the elephant's shoulders. And now you want
me to climb on a jackass. I tried to be serious.
Upshaw includes a seldom-heard aria from Menotti's The Old Maid and the Thief, a one-act opera composed for NBC Radio in 1939. It's too close to Puccini for comfort, but at least it's a refreshing change from the usual recital material. Upshaw ends the album brilliantly with Anne Truelove's classical, or is it neoclassical, rescue aria from Stravinsky's Rake's Progress. The hero of the opera is Tom Rakewell, the wild youth in William Hogarth's famous series of paintings. Rakewell nearly loses his soul to the devil in the wicked city of London. Here, Anne resolves to leave her father and naively but heroically trusts her future happiness to her loving heart.
Dawn Upshaw's new album, Knoxville, Summer of 1915, is on Nonesuch. Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. I'll Take It is Paul Rudnick's new comic novel about compulsive shopping. More specifically, it's about shopping with your mother. The story opens as the 26-year-old Yale-educated and unemployed Joe is getting picked up at his Manhattan apartment by his mother. They, along with his two aunts, are setting out on a drive through New England to see the leaves change color. But this trip is really just an excuse to stop at all the stores and discount outlets along the way. Paul Rudnick is a humorist who's written for Spy, Esquire, and Vanity Fair. I asked Paul if shopping plays an essential role in his life.
Yes, it certainly does. That's why I wrote the book. And I found it a very sort of worthwhile and generally delightful pursuit. And I wanted to write a book that was sort of a tribute to shopping and something to honor it instead of, I think there's a usual tendency to either be ashamed for it to be everyone's secret shame and hidden passion, or for it to be looked on as sort of the, you know, the dark underbelly of capitalism. But I think it's, you know, a major plus.
Let me ask you, if you think of as shopping as being a lot of people's dirty secret, when did you come out about shopping?
Oh, I think I was never in. I think it was, I was sort of indoctrinated since birth. And it's just been a one long river since then.
Your book is not only a tribute to shopping, but it's also a tribute to shopping with relatives, to shopping with a mother, with aunts. What values do your mother and aunts represent to you in the cosmology of shopping?
Ah, well, first I should say that my mother and aunts also have represented a universe of wonderful things to me. Not just shopping, that there was an emphasis on museum going and theater and other people and kindness and all sorts of things, which all could be combined with shopping. That was why I always admired my mother and my aunts, was that they managed to find the shopping element in activities that would somehow seem to exclude it. So some of these I cover in the book, that when we would go to the Metropolitan Museum to show that we were cultured intellectual types, we would always know that there was a reward at the end of, you know, all the Van Goghs and all the Picassos. We knew that there would be a gift shop, and that would sort of keep you going. It would be the carrot. So I think I was taught that, oh, the shopping was a wonderful reward. There was that it was an adventure, that, that a bargain could never hurt you. What else? That I think it was just viewed as, oh, an expedition. That's from my earliest memories, or of setting out and of the discovery of it all, and that shopping was something where that was different all over the world, and that you would, it was a way to learn about whatever place you were visiting, from New England to France to California. You would see what were the local crafts, what were, and of course, what was the shirt that you wanted in New Jersey that cost $29.98, you might find in South Dakota for, you know, a third off. So, you know, justifying the entire nation that way.
Paul?
Yes?
As you know, you're joining us from the New York Bureau in Manhattan, and your mother, Selma Rudnick, is in the studio with me in Philadelphia, and I'd like to introduce her. Selma Rudnick, welcome.
Hello, Terry.
Hi, Selma Rudnick.
Hi, Paul Rudnick.
I think this is this whole interview is merely a method of saving on the phone bill. Very handy.
Not a bad idea, Paul.
I want to talk a little bit about the experience of parent and child shopping together. I think this is a universal experience that we've all had with varying success. I'd like to ask first, when you first started shopping together as a teen.
Well, Paul used to just get dragged along because we really didn't hire a babysitter when we were going shopping. We would just say, get in the car, we're going shopping.
Like a puppy.
And Paul was pretty good-natured about the whole thing because he usually brought a book to read. I didn't know at the time that he was probably bringing a paper and pencil. Had I known that, I probably would have left him home.
A paper and pencil taking notes of
that's
the experience.
That's right, exactly, that he was starting his book at the age of six. And many people have asked him how he knows so much about the Lohmann's dressing room, for instance. But he was a good sport about coming along, and he did reach a certain stage in adolescence where he didn't want to be seen with his parents either shopping or doing anything else for that matter. And Paul, you may well remember that when we went to Europe and you were an adolescent, the minute we hit a store or a museum, you would say, I'll meet you here in half an hour, and then make tracks so that nobody would think that you were conceivably related to myself or your father.
Well, I think you've hit on something, and that is I think there is a period in every son or daughter's life when they don't want to shop with their mother or father because they're slightly embarrassed about the whole thing. And then you get a little bit older and you realize no one is going to be more honest with you about how something looks than your parent with you, right? Yeah.
Well, except you see, I think it all relates to a basic moment, which is the purchase of a bar mitzvah suit.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Which if you go to Barney's in New York especially, although there was a certain store in New Jersey as well, you will see a mother usually with a 12 or nearing 13-year-old son, and they will be deciding what he should wear at his bar mitzvah, whether it should be a simple dark suit, or in my case, I broke precedent and wore a sports jacket with contrasting slacks. But that moment is, I think, when there's sort of the shopping separation, when you realize your taste might be different from your parents, and that it's a moment of a lot of whining, I think.
Paul, do you think of this book as being autobiographical?
In certain elements, I think it certainly is. There are things in this book that are true fiction.
I think he draws on certain experiences that I recognize. Then again, he has drawn these characters much, much larger than life. And it did make me very nervous reading it the first time. And as I said to Terry before, I think that I thought I was going to have to start a support group made up of Nancy Reagan and the late Joan Crawford and perhaps a few other people whose children had taken out after them. But I do think it's an affectionate book. I try to tell myself that.
And, but I think it really is. I think that's really clear that it's this really loving relationship with a lot of teasing going on between the mother and son.
That we certainly do in our family, and that is the way we communicate. But Paul has a vivid imagination, and he has really enlarged on certain experiences in a way that really interests me.
Paul, let me ask you, when you were writing the novel, did you, because I always wonder this with writers, did you feel like, I should talk this over with my mother and see if she'll be offended by any of the scenes? I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that could really cripple a novelist. On the other hand, you don't want to feel like you're going to be hurting the feelings of anybody in your family.
Right, yes. No, that was very much a concern, but I didn't want to, and I knew my mother would not want me to feel somehow to shake the whole time I was writing it.
What makes you think that?
why should writing be different than any other moment of the day?
I thought Paul was very generous in letting us read this before it was set in type. And the changes that we suggested or hoped that he would make were really extremely minor. I asked for only one change about myself. Remember what it was, Paul? Only one.
No, what?
You had me reading a poet.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead. Remember?
Yes, I think I had you reading. Who did?
You said I was reading Sylvia Plath, and I
no,
said...
No, I didn't. I said you were reading Anne Sexton.
Oh, Anne Sexton. I said, please change that to Elizabeth Bishop.
See, aren't we a Tony family?
That was the only change.
I like that. You know, that real sense of literary shame of being identified with a less than top drawer poetess.
I think I should end this interview by saying that I really like shopping with my mother a lot. And in fact, for the occasion of this interview, I wore something that she got for me on one of our shopping trips together.
She has good taste, I can tell.
I hope she's listening and heard that.
And can I say one last thing?
Sure.
Which is, I think I'm very brave. You don't see John Updike going on the air with Mrs. Updike. I dare him.
It's a wise child who knows his own mother.
Well, I want to thank you again, both.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Paul Rudnick's new novel, I'll Take It, is published by Knopf. Selma Rudnick is the public relations director for All Star Forum in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, an interesting Supreme Court decision today.
I think it is interesting, Terry, in light of the fact that the court has been making fairly conservative decisions. Today they decided you could do anything with the flag you wanted to, including burn the flag. We're also looking at lead stories on daycare. The legislation is before the Senate. On China, there were executions in Shanghai, as you know. Rafsanjani, the Iranian leader, is visiting Moscow, and an agreement has been reached between those two countries. We're spending a lot of time on the environment this summer. Today, we're going to be looking at a cleanup plan for oil spills and at the problems with New England shellfish.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Novelist and poet Marge Piercy is one of the leading feminist writers of our day. Her 9 novels include Small Changes, Vita, and Woman on the Edge of Time. And her latest collection of poems is Available Light. It's appropriate that Piercy's new novel be published now. It's called Summer People. Critic Maureen Carrigan has this review.
Someone's in the bedroom with Dinah. Is it Willie, her lover of 10 years, who creates unfashionable political sculpture? Is it Susan, Willie's wife, a fabric designer who's also been Dinah's lover for the past 10 years? Maybe it's Itzhak. I hope so. He's moody, but then he is a virtuoso flutist, and he understands Dinah's avant-garde music. Even more important, he wants to settle down, and he's not involved with either Willie or Susan. The ménage à trois of Willie, Susan, and Dinah is the focus of Marge Piercy's Summer People. After the tremendous scope of her recent World War II novel, Gone to Soldiers, Summer People initially seems like summer reading, light, sexy, and absolutely implausible. Take this triangle business. Dinah remembers learning in high school geometry that triangles are highly stable structures. But in my experience, they're as enduring as the human pyramid formation at cheerleading tryouts. To keep this one from wobbling, the three characters maintain a vigorous schedule of conjugal visits. Here's a description of their annual Christmas festivities. They opened some presents together, but each of them was entitled to separate time for a private present or two with the others. They would adjourn to Willie and Susan's to open some presents with the children. After that, Dinah went home, and Willie gave Susan her private presents. They always made love on Christmas Eve. In the morning, he got up early and went to bring Dinah her presents. They made love that morning. When Susan had finally had brunch, she would go down to find Dinah, and they would share early or mid-afternoon of Christmas Day. Then in the late afternoon, the three of them would walk to the bay. Phew, and you thought Mommy kissing Santa Claus was a big deal. Despite this silliness, Summer People doesn't represent Marge Piercy's vacation from her familiar political themes. She closely examines the class tensions between artists like Dinah, Willie, and Susan, who, like Piercy herself, work on Cape Cod year-round, and the wealthy Summer People who visit for pleasure. Then there's the larger issue of one's responsibility to the past. As the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, Dinah thinks she should have children to memorialize those who perished. These storylines are compelling, but Piercy's greatest gift as a novelist and social observer is that she can make even the most outlandish choices for living seem unthreatening, even ordinary. She therefore moves her readers to consider all sorts of possibilities for change. Halfway through the novel, when the triangle finally collapses, it no longer seems like an over-choreographed romp, but a credible, if exhausting, alternative to the nuclear family that Willie and Susan found so stifling. The urge to challenge convention influences Piercy's writing style as well. She doesn't believe, as some critics of Dinah's music do, in the unbridgeable gap between culture high and culture low. Piercy's not afraid of using popular forms like science fiction, as she did in Woman on the Edge of Time, or the romance, as she does here, to convey her essentially political themes. Summer People is as thought-provoking and difficult to categorize as any of Piercy's fiction. It's speech reading with muscle.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Bryn Mawr College and contributes book reviews to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we deal with Batman. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the blockbuster to be, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews an album of songs from Batman written and performed by Prince. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. NPR, National Public Radio.